The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, The Space Age. Billions of dollars have to be spent by employers to create office space that can be functional, safe, and productive. But will that be enough to bring back workers? And the cover story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline, Is this the end of the open office as we know it? Thermal imaging could offer solutions for workplace screening. And this is written by David Pertell. As offices and venues across the triangle consider resuming normal operations, some may look to invest in thermal imaging equipment for screening the temperature of employees. The technology, using digital infrared imaging to map heat patterns in the skin, has been commonplace in the medical, security, and defense fields for years. But its use has grown more widespread with the onset of pandemics from H1N1 in 2009 to the present crisis with COVID-19. Thermal imaging cameras can be specifically calibrated to detect elevations in skin and body temperature and allow people to be screened quickly at a safe distance from the camera's operator. In the office setting, the use of thermal technology for screening workers is the topic of discussion, according to John Linderman, Avison Young Managing Director in Raleigh. Avison Young's office in Wade Park reopened after Memorial Day, but instead of having 55 or so workers, the in-house figure is currently between 8 and 12, he says. The office has multiple handheld thermal thermometers, so employees can do spot checks, Linderman says. Those devices cost under $100 and are contactless. He says employees have not objected to using the devices and that Avison Young has been learning about the potential for thermal imaging to better inform its clients. Linderman says as more workers return to the office, the company likely will implement a more organized process for screening temperatures. He says he doesn't have concerns about it being seen as an invasion of privacy. Here's the thing. Aren't we already being constantly monitored? Linderman says regarding the digital era. There is a lot of monitoring, and that is already going on. He adds that people haven't noticed it because the buildup has been gradual over time. If I show up at your office, you want to know if I'm sick, right? Linderman says, calling the current environment the new normal. Dr. John Pittman with Raleigh's Carolina Center for Integrative Medicine has been using thermal imaging for years. It's known as thermology. In the medical field, one of its primary uses is to screen for breast cancer. Pittman says the technology has advanced and the costs have dropped dramatically. He says they bought their first thermal imaging system in 2004 at a cost of $100,000. In 2015, the price was $30,000. Today, handheld cameras can cost up to several thousand dollars, and complete systems can reach above $10,000. Everybody's asking questions about thermography in light of the pandemic, Pittman says. He says the H1N1 pandemic led to a rise in the use of thermal imaging for temperature screening, especially in airports. This is mostly useful where you have large crowds and need to screen people quickly, he says. He doesn't think its use would be too practical or for small or medium-sized offices, but when it comes to office buildings with hundreds of workers, event venues, or facilities such as meatpacking plants, that's when the technology makes sense, Pittman says, because it allows a large number of people to be screened at a fast pace. Airports such as Los Angeles International are testing thermal imaging cameras for passenger screening amid the pandemic. Raleigh-Durham International Airport says it's not screening passengers' temperatures as it is not mandated by the Centers for Disease Control. Pittman says one of the most well-known companies behind the technology is FLIR Systems, based in Oregon, and the company has been rolling out new products aimed at providing businesses with options for temperature screenings. These cameras are our easiest cameras to set up and operate to date for skin temperature screening, requiring limited training to begin screening people more quickly and accurately, says Jim Cannon, president and CEO at FLIR, spelled F-L-I-R, in a recent announcement about updated products. Locally, security companies such as Brady Services, which is based in Greensboro with locations in the Triangle, have started to offer thermal imaging solutions for the workplace. But when it comes to how widespread the use of the technology could become, Avis and Young's Linderman says it all depends on how the spread of the virus continues. I think businesses will embrace every type of technology they can to keep doing business, he says. And there's another small article along with this, with information from the Food and Drug Administration. Four tips, thermal imaging, what you need to know. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has issued guidance to apply to all thermal imaging systems that are intended for medical purposes for the duration of the public health emergency related to COVID-19. Use properly. When used correctly, thermal imaging systems generally have been shown to accurately measure someone's surface skin temperature without being physically close to the person being evaluated. Thermal imaging systems offer certain benefits in that other methods need a closer proximity or contact to measure temperature. Not a test. Temperature-based screening, such as thermal imaging, is not effective in determining if someone definitely has COVID-19. A diagnostic test must be performed to determine if someone has the virus. Not always accurate. Thermal imaging systems have been shown to be accurate when used to take the temperature of multiple people at the same time. Have not been shown to be accurate when used to take the temperature of multiple people at the same time. The accuracy of these systems depends on careful setup and operation, as well as proper preparation of the person being evaluated. Used everywhere. Thermal imaging systems have been used by several countries during epidemics, although information about their effectiveness as part of efforts to reduce the spread of disease has been mixed. And we also have a related article written by Connie Gentry. The headline, Architects Share Visions for Offices in the Now Normal and Beyond. Flexibility is critical, architects say, as companies look to re-envision their offices as they plan for an eventual return to work once the pandemic ebbs. Temperature checks, social distancing signage, staggered schedules, increased cleaning and sanitation stations are becoming ubiquitous office practices. But the pandemic creates a long list of workspace areas to be addressed, from how do people move from one point to another to even the air we breathe. The money you invest needs to prepare for workers to return, but the design has to be ready for another shutdown, says Marcus Ackison, workplace studio principal in the Durham office of Little. But the changes and challenges come at a time when employers are being cautious, as the pandemic has threatened both revenue streams and the safety of employees. We've done analysis with clients to see how they might alter spaces, and most have opted not to make large-scale adjustments because they don't have a lot of people in the offices. It costs a lot of money, and what exactly will be needed is still unclear, says Paul Battaglia, principal at Clark Nexen. Architects are exploring how best to utilize the spaces that exist, and short of making large-scale modifications, what can be altered in a cost-effective manner to create safer environments. We're taking it on a case-by-case basis, encouraging people not to spend a lot of money and looking at things they can do temporarily without a lot of construction, says Sharon Crawford, interior studio principal in Little's Durham office. I keep saying, let's not do any regret work. Let's not go spend money and then in a year or 18 months realize you're stuck with something. People flow. How people move through the workspace, especially across communal spaces and from one floor to another, is one of the first areas to address, but it creates a multitude of challenges. MHA Works' Jared Martinson says, the challenge is less about design and more about identifying clear protocols. For example, that means using interior signage to identify circulation paths, especially for big open offices in places such as American Tobacco or Red Hat. For a lot of our office clients, the challenge is less about a design or construction solution and more about identifying a clear protocol that addresses the needs of the company and is informed by input from employees at all levels of responsibility, says Martinson, the director of mixed use and family multifamily projects, as well as the director of the Durham office. Elevators pose one of the biggest conundrums in office settings. Little Zackison says elevators are probably the biggest sore point. While limiting occupancy in an elevator is inevitable, there are discussions of possibly making elevators operate with touchless or voice-activated commands. That's a very expensive idea. What we're seeing as an alternative is some focus on the stairs and trying to make stairways more pleasant spaces, he says. It's easy to accommodate social distancing in stairwells by simply dedicating one set of stairs for going up and another for coming down. One of our clients is entertaining the idea of using their stairs as a public art space with murals or adding more windows. Atkinson says it's a very healthy idea and it gets into the WELL building concept. The WELL building standard, administered by the International WELL Building Institute, monitors building features that impact the health and well-being of people who work, live, or interact in them. Where LEED is focused on sustainability, WELL takes ideas to the level of what is best for the human experience, explains Atkinson. Air quality. Another area that WELL focuses on relative to COVID-19 is the importance of implementing safe HVAC systems, improved ventilation, fresh air, and humidity controls. To kill over 99% of all disease and viruses in one pass, we recommend adding high-intensity UVC energy that is emitted from UVGI lamps, says Miles Grubbs, a mechanical engineer in Little's Durham office. These lamps can be added in a variety of places within the HVAC system, but we recommend placement just downstream from the coil in the main air handling units, between the coil and the fan. Placing the lamp in this location would kill the viruses in the air that passes through and provide an added benefit of cleaning the coil and the drain pan. Placing the UVC lighting in HVAC ductwork is also an option, and the galvanized metal is an excellent reflector of UV light. The recommended budget is 40 cents per square foot for a retrofit. The bulbs would need to be changed yearly at a cost of about $100 per bulb. Currently, Little is replacing the HVAC system in medical clinics that range from 5,000 to 8,000 square feet at a cost of about $500 to $600, Grubb says. Adding UVC lighting to HVAC units in new construction costs less than retrofits, but Little cautions against using bipolar ionization, another technology under consideration for improving air quality, because it has not been shown to eliminate viruses. Natural solutions. Circulating fresh air, which can be done via mechanical or natural means or simply with windows that open, improves air quality. Expanding offices into outdoor settings is also helpful. The outdoor amenity has been a big selling feature for several years for office buildings, and now you'll see a lot more terraces, balconies, and rooftops. Even the landscape architecture around the building is going to become more important as we realize the need to engage outdoors, Atkinson says. At MHA Works, Martinson notes, where the focus of the budget might have been on interior environments in the past, I can think of an example in Durham where the conversation has been around creating multi-use, flexible, and inviting exterior amenity spaces that will offset the boundaries of the indoor environment. What is needed to make the outdoor setting as viable as the traditional office is technology. All workplaces have to have charging stations, outlets, bandwidth, everything that is needed to be able to work, Crawford says. This is the now normal. New normal. Working from home has become not only the norm, but also the preferred practice, particularly as the threat of the pandemic lingers. What workers miss is the experience and interaction of collaborative meetings. The challenge, as Martinson notes, is to establish social distancing within a collaborative meeting room. Perhaps we'll figure out how some of the work-from-home technology can be used within office spaces, he says. In fact, I believe the popularity of open spaces has been declining in recent years. Martinson adds, the other thing that was starting to happen is the idea of automation of public spaces through touchless technology. If my kids can tell Siri to play the song from the Trolls movie, there's no reason why we can't train an elevator to work off voice remote, he concludes. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. New look for concerts. A concert could end up looking more like a tailgate party in the era of COVID-19. Chuck Purvis, CEO of Coastal Federal Credit Union, confirms he's had loose discussions with Live Nation about options for the music park that bears his company's name. Coastal Credit Union Music Park at Walnut Creek is unlikely to host another concert this year, Purvis says. I don't think any of the ones still scheduled will happen, he says. But Coastal, which signed a contract extension for the naming rights to the park in January, is meeting in the next several weeks with Live Nation to talk options for social distancing in the 6,000-capacity venue. One of those options might be a drive-in concert, utilizing the vast parking lots for essentially a concert tailgate. Everything is on the table, says Purvis. I've said COVID-19 is going to unleash the next wave of innovation in this country, he says, and music parks will be included in the mix. Mural showcases new Durham living quarters. As work wraps up on a long-awaited apartment complex overlooking Durham Central Park, the developers, community stakeholders, and a local artist are gearing up for a warm welcome on opening day. After years of planning, preparation, and work, opening day is approaching for Blue Heron Asset Management's Foster on the Park apartment project, and in preparation, the firm brought on Raleigh artist Taylor White to paint a mural on the side of the development facing the park. White says the mural will take about 2 weeks to complete, and work was slated to begin on July 8. This project has been long in development between myself, the developers, and the committee in charge of Durham Central Park, which the mural directly faces, White told Biz. It will be my first project in Durham. Churches tap into PPP. With the release of loan data for the U.S. Small Business Administration's Paycheck Protection Program, Biz noticed an intriguing trend. Local faith-based organizations received millions of dollars. For example, the Catholic Diocese of Raleigh received between $2 million and $5 million, and so did the Summit Church of Durham with its campus in Briar Creek. The Baptist State Convention of North Carolina, based in Cary, also landed a PPP loan between $2 million and $5 million. Also in Cary, Christ the King Lutheran Church received between $150,000 and $350,000. Biz counted more than a dozen individual churches just in Durham, Raleigh, or Cary that received PPP. Faith-based organizations are eligible to receive SBA loans regardless of whether they provide secular social services. And also on this page, we have a section from American City Business Journal CEO Whitney Shaw. The headline, Words Matter, But Actions Matter Most. We listened to voices that forced a look back at what never should have been. We listened to voices that encouraged a look ahead to what must be. We heard hope and optimism. We heard frustration and fatigue. In the past month, Triangle Business Journal and other business journals facilitated local conversations on race and racism. The words were raw, emotional, and disturbing. They were also honest and inspiring. Tears were shed without embarrassment. Many listened in silence, then spoke. Others struggled to find words. Sadly, some were defensive. For virtually all, the conversations ended with acknowledgement that more must be done, that words must be followed by action. It is a very small start, too many years in the making. One hopeful sign is that white business owners and executives agreed without hesitation that they have a responsibility to eliminate systemic racism, especially in the workplace. They committed to doing the heavy lifting, working in concert with black colleagues and contemporaries. Looking ahead, there will be many more conversations in communities coast to coast, including in the nearly 50 cities where American City Business Journals has a significant presence. Built on the best foundations of journalism, ACBJ is in a unique position to serve the cities it calls home. We take that to heart, never forgetting that words, both written and spoken, have the power to inform and inspire, honor and enlighten. Perhaps most important today, words have the power to initiate and support long-needed change. While recent events unquestionably have massive societal and political implications, there is also no question this is a seminal moment for companies large and small, public and private, as well as the people who work in them. Business must lead. We understand words without action will be meaningless. Only action, specifically sustained action, will eliminate systemic racism. Like many companies, we've looked inward with a critical eye and a profound sense of urgency. We've also looked outward and said in a strong, determined voice, Black Lives Matter. Never again should any black man repeatedly say, I can't breathe, whether while being restrained by the knee of a police officer or by a system that denies him equal access to education, health care, opportunity, and basic human rights. As we look in the mirror, we know we must do better. That journey has already begun. We are reviewing recruiting and hiring practices across the entire company. These reviews will lead to concrete action steps aimed at significantly improving the racial diversity of ACBJ. These are additional steps ACBJ has taken or will take. We're expanding our minority internships and business reporting from a summer-only program to year-round. In each of the 6 years the program has been in place, interns have been offered full-time jobs by the business journals and other media companies. More undoubtedly will be hired, especially as our program expands in length and number of participants. We're adding a diversity scholarship to our Ray Shaw Memorial Scholarship Program, which benefits children of ACBJ employees. This scholarship, like others in the program, will be administered by an independent third party, which is responsible for selecting winners. Details are currently being reviewed. We've formed working groups of ACBJ editors and reporters to focus on diversity in our coverage of local businesses and business people, diversity among panelists and speakers at Business Journal events, diversity among honorees recognized by the Business Journal, such as 40 Under 40 and similar programs, improving diversity in our newsrooms, including addressing shortcomings in hiring, career opportunities, and professional development, expanding existing relationships with historically black colleges and universities and professional associations such as the National Association of Black Journalists, creating a diversity, equity, and inclusion style book for our reporters and editors to guide them in the use of consistent and precise language. Similar groups in sales and other departments will be formed as well. We've committed to expanding current Business Journal programs that recognize and honor companies and individuals working to further diversity, equity, and inclusion. We've committed to connecting business people in all Business Journal markets, especially owners and C-suite executives, for additional conversations on race and racism. We've initiated conversations with experts on race and racism with the goal of introducing a training program in ACBJ and then making it available to others. We've supported the contributions made by the Samuel I. Newhouse Foundation, named for the founder of our parent company, to the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and the Equal Justice Initiative. We pledge to do more, and we'll update our communities as that happens. As a media company, we understand words matter. We don't hesitate to say actions matter most, including for us. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Tech, Finance, and Insurance page written by Lauren Onosorge. Why enforcing COVID-19 claims will be tough. Insurance regulators are gearing up, preparing for an onslaught of commercial claims issues stemming from the pandemic. But when it comes to business interruption insurance, there's little that can be done to enforce most claims, says North Carolina Department of Insurance Commissioner Mike Causey. I understand the difficult situation they're in, Causey says. I don't have the legal authority to force an insurance company to pay something that's not covered in a policy. Causey says that if legislators forced insurance companies to pay for pandemic losses, it would totally bankrupt most of the insurance companies. But he does plan to lobby for additional disclaimers on those policies, he says. I think clear communication is important, he says. I think the policyholders need to know what is covered and what is not covered in clear, no-nonsense language. So yes, I will be working with the industry as we address those issues to discuss those things. In the long term, Causey expects to see new specialized policies developed, similar to those developed after 9/11, that cover acts of terrorism. I believe in the future, maybe policies can be developed to cover various types of pandemics, he says. But as of now, it's of little comfort to business owners whose coffers continue to be decimated by weeks of forced closures. Zach Medford, whose firm owns multiple Raleigh bars such as Coughlin's and Isaac Hunter's Tavern, say tough choices are ahead. We're digging deep and consolidating resources, and we're definitely coming to the point where bills are coming due, and we're choosing which ones to pay, he says. His claim was denied by his insurer, as was the claim of Jonathan Sealbinder's firm, which also owns multiple bars, including The Architect in downtown Raleigh. We certainly pursued the claim and were denied like most everyone, he says. But some business owners haven't even tried, seeing little point, even amid mounting losses. Giannina Tessiner, who owns Arise Athletics in Knightdale, says she researched links for out-of-state law firms filing class action suits against companies denying claims. After realizing how relentless they are about contacting possible clients, I honestly saw it as a scam, she says. I contacted my local insurance agent to ask, and he says that policies don't cover events of this nature, so I didn't pursue it further. M&F CEO talks about why Netflix decision matters. Days after streaming giant Netflix announced plans to move $100 million to historically black banks, James Sill, CEO of the second oldest African-American financial institution in the country, says North Carolina firms, too, are stepping up their support for minority communities. We're seeing an uptick in business, Sills, the CEO of Durham-based M&F Bank, said. As the bank has yet to release its second quarter financials, Sill wasn't specific about the uptick, saying only that it was significant. At the end of March, M&F reported nearly $264.4 million in total assets, including $236.5 million in deposits. As black-owned or black-led banks make up just 1% of the commercial banking assets in the country, according to the FDIC, it will take a real infusion of dollars to see a systemic difference. As Netflix cited in its announcement, 19% of black families either have no assets or negative wealth. And Henry McCoy, professor and director of entrepreneurship at North Carolina Central University in Durham, blames that wealth gap for the recent social unrest. He said the change needs to go beyond the rebranding of entities such as Aunt Jemima and Uncle Ben's. Sills predicts moves like that of Netflix will further embolden others to take similar action. Foreign money pours into North Carolina ops. New data from 2019 shows foreign investment is again on the rise in North Carolina, but it's unclear how the pandemic might impact investment dollars going forward. International clients, many of them are still barred from coming into the United States, Chris Chung, CEO of the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, said in a recent interview, and that has delayed decisions on some projects in the pipeline. Nationwide, the numbers are down year over year. Investors overseas spent nearly $195 billion acquiring, establishing, or expanding U.S. businesses in 2019, according to new data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis. That's down nearly 38% from the nearly $313 billion in foreign direct investment recorded for 2018. But in North Carolina, the 2019 total of nearly $4 billion is up from the $2.4 billion reported in 2018. Pipeline halt could thwart new jobs factories in North Carolina. Economic developers say they're disappointed but not surprised at the decision by utility giants Dominion Energy and Duke Energy to halt the long-planned $8 billion Atlantic Coast pipeline. With the natural gas pipeline no longer happening, some fear job creators may think twice before putting the eastern part of the state in the running for certain manufacturing projects. The real danger in economic development projects is the calls you don't get, not the calls you do get, says Norris Tolson, CEO of Eastern North Carolina Economic Development Recruiter, Carolina's Gateway Partnership. The consultant looks at what the capabilities are of the sites they are looking at, and when they see that you are deprived or short on one of the infrastructure needs, you don't ever get the calls. Chris Johnson, director of Johnston County Economic Development, called the news a huge blow to the entire Interstate 95 corridor. And finally, in a section called Why It Matters, inside the new Hitachi ABB joint venture in Raleigh. Hitachi's 80% acquisition of ABB's power grids unit for $11 billion is complete, giving Raleigh yet another growing regional HQ operation. The joint venture will keep its headquarters at NC State University's Centennial Campus. The unit has 450 Raleigh employees, including most of the 150 new positions the company created for the new venture. A lot of these roles actually span between corporate functions, mainly finance, marketing, human resources, and the rest is research and development, says Joanne Barbosa, interim site lead and country finance director for Power Grids. Now we turn to Caleb Harshberger's page on real estate. Virginia firm wants 20 stories for development near Red Hat Amphitheater in downtown Raleigh. A Virginia real estate investment company is looking to capitalize on its recent investment in downtown Raleigh. Capital Square, with headquarters outside of Richmond, has filed a request with the city to rezone two parcels of land to allow for mixed-use development up to 20 stories tall. The parcels are situated on 1.32 acres at 320 and 328 West South Street, catter-cornered to the Red Hat Amphitheater along West Lenore Street. The properties currently feature a squat commercial structure and the Victory Tabernacle Church. Current zoning allows for development up to five stories high. Capital Square bought the properties for $4.2 million on April 20 this year. Filings did not include specific development plans, and company representatives did not return calls for comment. Capital Square is a national investment sponsor focused on tax-advantaged real estate offerings such as qualified opportunity zone funds and others, with some previous experience investing in the Triangle. The rezoning joins a growing list of moves by property owners and developers on the south side of downtown Raleigh. To the north of the site at 320 West South Street, a Greenville company has plans for a new residential development after assembling a collection of parcels at 301 West Cabarrus Street last year. A block to the west of Capitol Square's properties, Raleigh-based Dominion Realty Partners is moving ahead with plans for a massive multi-tower development called Salisbury Square. The project calls for four new structures, including two 20-story towers, a hotel, and a parking structure, with a total project cost exceeding $300 million. Elsewhere in downtown, Heritage Properties is looking to add an 18-story tower to its Block 83 development in Glenwood South. It would sit near One Glenwood and its sister tower, Tower 2. Luxury apartments will join site of Wegmans in Cary. The developers behind a Wegmans-anchored mixed-use destination in Cary have unveiled plans for a new luxury apartment community. On June 6, Fenton partnering firms Hines, Columbia Development, and USAA Real Estate announced plans for the Canopy at Fenton, a six-story, mixed-use luxury apartment community featuring 357 apartments and over 79,815 square feet of retail, restaurant, and entertainment space. That will make up part of the total 345,000 square feet of shops, restaurants, and entertainment space in the first phase of Fenton, which is situated along Carytown Boulevard at Interstate 40. We've been focused on both the multifamily component and how it functions and how it integrates with the rest of the project, says Paul Zarian, director for Hines. We're really excited about how these elements come together. Apartments at the Canopy at Fenton will feature a mix of studio, one, two, and three-bedroom units, with most featuring one- or two-bedroom layouts. The ground floor will have four loft-style units featuring 20-foot ceilings and mezzanines opening over rooms and access to a backyard courtyard. All residents will have access to four public terraces as well as a multi-level fitness center, club room, elevated pool deck, and five common terraces that overlook the rest of Fenton. On the second floor, 47 of the units will feature private terraces ranging from 70 to 500 square feet over the retail and entertainment space. Town home development mapped near Raleigh Sports Park. A largely undeveloped property in Raleigh could become the site for nearly 100 new townhomes. Last month, Parker Poe filed a rezoning request on behalf of the property owners of 10.5 acres in northeast Raleigh to allow for the development of a proposed multifamily community. The land is situated at 6125 Buffalo Road and is surrounded by residential neighborhoods. It's just north of Buffalo Road Athletic Park. The rezoning would allow for as many as 140 new homes, But filings say current development plans expect to bring up to 97 townhomes to the property. The rezoning would also allow for single-family or two-unit homes. The filings did not name the developer of the project. The site currently has just one residential unit on it. Representatives for the applicants hosted a virtual neighborhood meeting on June 1 and answered questions on topics ranging from traffic concerns and stormwater management to lighting and potential impacts on neighboring property values. June property sales top $1 billion in Wake County. After months of sluggish activity, Wake County saw a surge in property sales in June amid growing demand and strong lending activity. A report by Wake County Register of Deeds Charles Gilliam shows the county closed last month with 3,685 deeds recorded, up 25% from May and up 3% year over year. In dollar amounts, those sales totaled nearly $1.2 billion. That's up 35% from the prior month and just a little below June of 2019. The surge continues a rebound that appears to have begun in May and accelerated last month. While this bodes well for the market, Gilliam says he's staying cautious. June actual results denote a quick turnaround, he said. For one thing, we need to see if an eventual pickup in commercial activity confirms the strength in the core market. Much of the gains were on the residential side, and while commercial sales did make some gains last month, activity remained slow. Owner of Wells Fargo buildings in Raleigh eyes new development. The owner of a large office campus in Raleigh is looking to add to the collection with a new office tower up to seven stories tall. Last month, Florida-based consolidated Tomaca Land Company filed a rezoning request with the City of Raleigh to allow for the development of a new office tower that could also include retail uses. The property currently features three office buildings totaling 450,000 square feet of office space on 34 acres at 1100 Corporate Center Drive in West Raleigh. The buildings have housed Wells Fargo operations since they opened in the late 1990s. The rezoning impacts 6 acres that make up a southwest portion of the property. The existing zoning allows for up to 5 stories of development, which appears to have not been enough for the company's plans. Filings with the city don't list a development plan, number of stories, or maximum square footage. According to request, the proposed rezoning would allow for a mix of retail and office uses on the site. And it goes on to cite nearby office and multifamily properties that may benefit from the mix. And now we turn to Seth Thomas Gulledge's page on healthcare and higher education. Triangle schools face threat from new restrictions on student visas. On July 7, the Trump administration announced a new directive that would take away visas for international students studying in the country if their sponsor university moves to online-only classes. The policy has immediately been attacked by much of higher education, with concerns that the policies will lead to a drop in foreign enrollment and accessibility. On July 8, both Harvard and Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, sued the federal government over the policy. In the Triangle, Duke University has joined in the public opposition through a public statement from its president, Vincent Price. "We are deeply concerned about the administration's new immigration directive that will limit the ability of qualified students and scholars to begin or continue their studies in the United States," Price said. "This is a misguided effort that will only harm talented young people and the colleges and universities that are vital to our society." Even before the directive was handed down this week, Triangle educators had expressed concern about that the pandemic would lead to less foreign enrollment in universities. If the directive stays, the number could be affected even more. In its most recently reported academic year, Duke University reported 3,851 of its 16,130 students, 23%, were international, the majority being graduate students. About 8% of its new freshman class were international students. Other Triangle universities, though sporting substantially less significant percentages of international students, still cater to thousands of international scholars. At UNC Chapel Hill, the school reported a total of 1,772 international students, less than 10% of its student body, in academic year 2018. NC State University reported 4,661 international students the same year, composing roughly 13% of its student body. Concerns about coronavirus declining in North Carolina even as cases rise. Even as COVID-19 cases continue to rise amid warnings from health officials, North Carolinians are becoming less worried about the pandemic, according to a new poll from Elon University. Just 53% of the more than 1,400 people polled in late June said they were personally worried about developing severe illness from coronavirus and spreading it to others. That figure is down from 57% in March. But 69% said they had concerns about a family member. "Most people are still very cautious and are still very concerned about illness or spreading coronavirus, and the majority are still worried about its impact in their financial situation," said Jason Husser, the director of the Elon poll and a professor of political science. "However, that's declining. The financial worries have declined a good bit." And there are two percentages listed with this article, 53%. Just 53% of the more than 1,400 people polled this month said they were personally worried about developing severe illness from coronavirus and spreading it to others. And also 74%. However, despite that waning concern, the survey also found that 74% of the state's residents support the recent statewide mask mandate enacted by Governor Roy Cooper. UNC eager to solve reopening question. As COVID-19 cases continue to rise in the state and the country wrestles over reopening, UNC Chapel Hill is bringing together economic researchers and executives from across North Carolina in an effort to help policymakers and business leaders weigh the trade-offs related to reopening. Labeled the NC CEO Forum, the group is an apolitical, nonpartisan collection of business leaders, according to Christian Lundblad, a UNC Kenan Flagler professor and research director with the Kenan Institute. The group will be working alongside the Kenan Institute to guide decision makers in the state and develop a framework for weighing the impact of reopening. The need for such a forum, according to Lundblad, is precipitated by the continuing lockdowns related to the pandemic. Economic activity is the lifeblood of American well-being. That deserves consideration, he said. If the sole policy objective were to limit the spread of our virus that we're struggling with, then a lockdown would be a remarkably effective tool. However, while that was necessary, the lockdown has exacted a significant human toll along some other important dimensions. ICVIA nets deal for huge clinical sites expansion in Canada. A Triangle Contract Research Organization, or CRO, has locked down a deal that will give it the largest network of clinical sites in Canada. Durham-based ICVIA, spelled I-Q-V-I-A, announced July 2nd, it has inked a strategic alliance with LMC Mana Research, Canada's largest network of fully owned integrated sites. The move will give the Durham CRO its first prime site in the country, adding to its current network of about 980 prime and partner sites across the globe. Prime sites are sites with special designations by the company that indicate they are premier investigative research centers with infrastructure focused on innovation and research development. Our partnership with LMC Mana Research leverages a strong infrastructure and transformational technologies to bring research to communities across Canada, says Richard Staub, ICVIA's President of Research and Development Solutions. For ICVIA, the prime site designation assures ICVIA's partner pharmaceutical and biotech companies that their clinical trials will take place in premier investigative research centers with recognized professionals and with infrastructure focused on innovation and research development for patients. LMC currently has 22 trials across three provinces in Canada, boasting access to well over 500,000 patients. Under the terms of the deal, ICVIA will provide staff dedicated to LMC, including a site manager who will oversee partnership relations and follow up on the delivery of ICVIA research projects. The companies also plan to collaborate on research programs in order to optimize processes and reduce the time it takes to start clinical trials. And finally, in a section called He Said It, the quote, "We're always concerned about the affordability question because that's what it always comes down to. So yes, the potential price tag is obviously something that we pay very close attention to. There is no question that what has not changed is our commitments, the ones we've made and the ones we will continue to make." And that's from Dr. Tunde Satunde, the new president and CEO of Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, on the more than $600 million price tag the company estimates COVID-19 and its responses will cost it this year. Now we turn to On Restaurants and Retail, written by Dathan Kazik. Bar opens for business. A trio of entrepreneurs are not waiting to start new venture. Opening a new business during the middle of a pandemic can be rather risky. Opening a new cocktail bar during that same period may seem insane, but that's what Zach Thomas, Josh Gagne, and Gaurav Patel are banking on. Their new cocktail lounge, Killjoy, opened earlier this month in what was the old Blue Martini location across the pavement from Clouds Brewing Company. The look inside the posh Killjoy is somewhat akin to a lavish lounge, where upon entering, you'll see a selfie wall blooming with flowers with the lounge's name nestled inside them. Currently, Killjoy is only seating guests via online reservations, with tables and chairs equally distanced to abide by current regulations. "People are really liking the space," says co-owner Thomas. "I think the biggest thing is getting people socially adjusted and distanced, which we are able to do with the size space we have." With the original opening date for Killjoy set in late March, Thomas and the rest of the owners have had a long wait to make their dream come true. With almost a 90-day delay, it must have been difficult. "We were in the midst of hiring and training our staff, and then the lockdown happened," Thomas says. To help them get through those days, they set up a crosstown cocktail program, which is essentially non-alcoholic cocktails to go. "That was to keep the lights on for us, and it also helped keep us relevant because trying to build a brand in the middle of a pandemic is kind of tough." What makes this bar stand out is its unique non-alcoholic drinks one can find on the menu. Thomas, who has been sober for the past 2 years, has put together concoctions such as the tahini colada using sesame and bay leaf amongst some of the regular colada ingredients. Other ingredients you might find include cactus tonic, whipped Granny Smith apples, oak bark tea, and aloe. Aloe is super thick and viscous. We just blend it up. We mix it in the cocktail, just shake it up. It's very nice and velvety, so it almost has that same effect that a Manhattan would, Thomas says. If you're wondering where the name Killjoy was derived, Thomas says it came from his father, who also is a bartender. When Thomas told his dad about opening a cocktail bar, his reply to him was, "Well, damn, I hope you enjoy being a full-time Killjoy, because that's what we are." And with Thomas being a sober bartender, he says the name is almost a big joke to him today. Bars looking for help from lawmakers as permit pay comes due. In a unanimous vote on July 7, statewide bars received a small form of relief when the North Carolina House approved SB 226. The bill still has to go to the state Senate and to Governor Roy Cooper for approval, but the North Carolina Bar and Tavern Association, or NCBATA, is hoping this bill will become a law. If passed, the bill would extend the fee deadline to 90 days after statewide bars are allowed to open. The deadline to renew current permits was at the end of June. The new bill would allow bars to request a refund. An average cost of the permit is about $2,000. Bar owners say many lawmakers worked together to construct the bill, including House Speaker Tim Moore. Senate Bill 226 is a step in the right direction, but next, the governor and the legislature need to immediately turn their attention to providing financial relief for businesses hit the hardest by the pandemic, says NCBATA President Zach Medford. At a time when billionaire Kanye West and Robert De Niro received millions of dollars in COVID-19 relief, North Carolina's bar owners are fighting just to keep roofs over their heads, Medford says. There is no industry more directly impacted by Governor Cooper's reopening plan than the bars. Medford is also calling for the formation of a tavern relief fund to give many of the 1,063 private bars across the state a lifeline. If you're going to ask bars to stay closed for the greater good, then you have to provide them some source of income, he says. Acclaimed chef closes Raleigh restaurant. Top Chef alum Katsuji Tanabe, who had local foodies and restaurant goers ablaze in 2019 when he opened High Horse inside Raleigh City Market, said July 8th that the restaurant will close permanently. Tanabe told Triangle Business Journal the decision to close didn't come lightly and that ultimately it wasn't his to make. It wasn't my decision. I am the chef, and I only have so much power. My partner and boss, he decided not to do it anymore, Tanabe says. Tanabe, who also runs Barrio in Chicago and Husong's Mexican Cantina in Las Vegas, knows how to run a successful business and says that for some, not knowing the business can lend itself to potential failure. This is a first-time restaurant owner, he says. A lot of these first-timers, they think they're going to open the door and have cash pouring in left and right. It's not like that anymore. The owner decided to rely on other investments where the return on investment was better than the restaurant. With that, since the restaurant closed in March, Tanabe estimates that High Horse, which was bringing in around $10,000 a day, lost roughly $500,000 in sales while not being able to recoup any of the losses. Since we've been closed, we never produced. All our food and dry goods have gone into the freezer and will probably stay there forever, he says. With the restaurant closing, it leaves around 50 employees without jobs. I take pride in my employees and me not being able to convince my partner to reopen. I take this as a failure, Tanabe says. I wish I could have done something better to give them their jobs back. He is currently reaching out to local contacts to see if he can't help find employment for as many of his staff as he can. And finally, in a section called He Said It, Michael Thor, co-owner of Raleigh's Whiskey Kitchen, on how the restaurant is holding up since reopening and keeping its capacity at 50%. We are very appreciative of the patience of our customers. Business is as good as we can hope for, as we're having to turn people away given our capacity limitations. We're grateful to have gotten our PPP loan. Without it, operating at 50% capacity wouldn't be sustainable. Hopefully, we'll be able to return to the pre-COVID business before we run through our loan money. And now we turn to the On Business page, written by David Pertell. NC unemployment payments top $5 billion. The numbers coming out of the state's Department of Employment Security continue to highlight the jobless crisis resulting from the pandemic. North Carolina has passed $5 billion in unemployment payments since mid-March. That figure includes more than $1.1 billion in state unemployment insurance, plus federal funds as part of the CARES Act passed in March. As of July 7, the state has paid out nearly $5.3 billion as more than 1.1 million people have filed unemployment claims in North Carolina, but 21%, or 235,000, of those who filed were determined to be ineligible. North Carolina had a little over $4 billion in its unemployment trust fund before the pandemic, meaning the state has burned through about 25% of its reserves. And new claims keep coming, including more than 50,000 between July 5th and July 6th. If the resurgence in the number of COVID-19 cases continues, it could put even more stress on the state's jobless reserves if businesses such as restaurants are forced to once again close their doors and lay off workers. When it comes to federal aid created through the CARES Act, the $600 weekly assistance for individuals in the form of pandemic unemployment compensation, essentially an add-on to regular state benefits, totals more than $2.8 billion in North Carolina so far. But that program is set to expire at the end of July unless Congress votes to extend it. Another federal program, Pandemic Unemployment Assistance, or PUA, is for self-employed individuals and independent contractors who aren't eligible for state unemployment benefits. That program has paid out more than $1.2 billion in the state. The third program, created through the CARES Act, is Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation, an extension to regular state unemployment payments for people who are still unemployed when their state benefits expire after 12 weeks. The program pays individuals a maximum of $350 per week in North Carolina and can last up to 13 weeks. So far, almost $91 million has been paid out in North Carolina through the program. People who are using PEUC will automatically receive the $600 in PUA through July. And finally on this page, law provides businesses with some liability relief. A bipartisan bill passed by the General Assembly and signed by Governor Roy Cooper on July 2nd provides some protection for businesses that implement COVID-19 mitigation plans. House Bill 118 allows businesses to be protected against claims that someone contracted the virus based on the business owner's negligence. In order to fall under the law, the owners must provide reasonable notice to people of the efforts they've taken to reduce the risk of transmission of COVID-19 on their premises. The law is effective immediately, but only applies to claims that fall within 6 months from when Governor Cooper's state of emergency expires. The law does not apply to workers' compensation claims. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Editor-in-Chief Sugata Mukherjee. The headline, PPP Forgiveness Process May Leave Big Mess Behind. So, after much deliberation, the federal government decided to release the names of small businesses that received more than $150,000 from the massive $660 billion Paycheck Protection Program. Although specific loan numbers were not released, the data broke it down in ranges, making it pretty easy to determine the companies that got the big money, $1 million and up. But as I've been saying for months now, the program's biggest challenge is going to come when companies start calling their lenders to get started on the next step to get their loans forgiven. Many banks have not even opened their portals to accept the forgiveness documents from businesses. That's because millions of businesses have not exhausted their PPP money to take the next step. They have until December 31, but the businesses that came in the first 2 weeks of the program in early April are out of the PPP money and are ready to take care of business, but it's not going to be that easy. Lenders are beginning to realize that the SBA may make it complicated to certify and approve the documentation process, enough to keep banks from registering those hefty fees on their books. In total, more than 4,000 lending businesses are in line to share anywhere from $14 billion to $24 billion in processing fees, according to a New York University and Stanford Law School study. Understandably, banks such as JPMorgan Chase and Bank of America stand to make the most because they made the most loans. But smaller banks and regional banks now have to decide exactly how long they want to keep the loans on their books. The longer they keep the loans, the longer it will take them to register the profits on their books. So on cue, the secondary market is heating up, and that is going to make the forgiveness process messier. In a rush to register the profits from the PPP initiative, many lenders will seek out entities willing to buy their entire portfolios of PPP loans at a discount. That means lenders will have to give up a percentage of the processing fees, but in return, will not have to worry about a single loan afterward and take their cash and go home. Already, a non-bank small business lender called The Loan Source has bought PPP portfolios from a bank in Maine and a bank in Pennsylvania. Both were community banks and collectively made some $750 million in PPP loans. Now, the borrowers who use those two banks have to deal with the Loan Source folks to get their forgiveness process started. And just how many of those small businesses know anyone at the Loan Source? You know the answer to that. Because the forgiveness process is expected to be complicated, with the federal agencies determined not to be embarrassed by fraud or intentional miscalculations, and lenders pushing to get these loans forgiven and taken off their books, it will be the small businesses who are most likely caught in the middle. And most businesses do not carry in-house accountants and lawyers to sort through the documentation process. They still have to run their shops. Maybe Congress will give a break to the smallest of the PPP takers, but for others, it might get messy. And in news from around the state, golf event delayed until 2022 at Quail Hollow, written by Eric Spanberg. Another round of COVID-19-related reshuffling has delayed the President's Cup at Quail Hollow Club while bringing back Charlotte's annual PGA Tour event sooner than expected, according to agreements discussed July 8 by golf's major sanctioning bodies. The President's Cup was scheduled to be played at Quail Hollow next year from September 30 through October 3. Because of the pandemic, golf's Ryder Cup, the biennial international team competition that inspired the President's Cup, this year is being moved to September 2021. That, in turn, pushes back the President's Cup to September 22 through 25, 2022. The tournaments alternate years. The PGA Tour owns and operates the President's Cup and sanctions the regular weekly tournaments, including the annual Wells Fargo Championship in Charlotte. A separate sanctioning body, the PGA of America, runs the Ryder Cup as well as the PGA Championship, one of golf's four major tournaments. And we'll stop there as the article goes on to mention the ripple effect that has led to Charlotte losing its annual PGA Tour event this year. And three of the four majors, the Masters, U.S. Open, and PGA Championships, rescheduled to later this year. And the fourth, the British Open, has been canceled. And finally, we have the Business Survey Pulse question. Do you agree with Governor Roy Cooper's decision to extend Phase 2 by 3 weeks? There were 236 responses. 67% say, yes, we need to slow the spread before moving forward. And 33% say, no, the economy can't afford it. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.